It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
No fear, no fear, no fear, no fear. You know, who should be more afraid than anyone else? You know, those that are in a position that represent the big bad Bubba government, have a uniform and a shiny badge and always available gun, they know the unlimited resources of the man that they're going up against if you turn against the man because they were the man. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about the drug war. We're going to be talking about First Amendment expression of, oh my goodness, if you have a uniform on. We've been covering these kind of things for a long time. And the reason is because it's so representative of the mindset of those that say they rule us. When you have the tip of the spear, when you have the military and law enforcement, police, I don't even like that word, law enforcement, you know, former peace officers, when they are the ones that are expected to take, liberties with your liberty. You know, how do you turn from that into someone that would abuse you to all of a sudden going, I don't want to do this anymore. All of a sudden they're the abused. They're the ones. They're the target. Because, man, you're not allowed to leave the gang. Certainly not with your pensions or whatever. I mean, they'll come after you. Now, who we're going to talk with today, retired police captain. Now, this retired police captain, Peter Crist, is a co-founder and current board member of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Now, his history is, he had a small town that he was a police captain of right outside of Buffalo, and it's Tonawanda. And you may not heard of it. I haven't. And it's 85,000 residents and 120 officers. You know, that's a good chunk of officers there. So I want to ask, I got you there, Peter. I got a couple of questions. I can just start and hopefully you just run off at the mouth because I got so many things I want to. I want to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself and so on. But, I have some questions. I got you there, Peter.
Yeah, I'm here. In fact, don't worry about running off at the mouth. My nickname at work used to be Motor Mouth.
Okay, well, we're going to get you going on it. This is my concern. This is what I want to talk about. And I know you probably get, in your conversations and interviews in the past, it's always, yeah, drugs are bad, but the drug war is worse, and this is why, and prohibition, and the corruption, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm sure we'll get into that. But I'll tell you what my real concern is. My concern is that when it becomes, at sooner or later, and probably sooner, every representation that the people have made of their position on this, be it at the ballot box, be it in the streets, be it, in the media, be it campuses, be it, they are in support of doing away with the drug war. And, it comes up for a vote to decriminalize marijuana. It's 60-something, 70-something percent. Big time here in Arizona. Then they challenge it. My question is not that you really have to convince people how screwed up this whole drug war is. That's really gaining a lot of traction. Certainly with people like, Gary Johnson and Dr. Paul on the presidential campaign making a big deal out of this and being supportive. Would you legalize heroin? Yep, heroin. My favorite thing. Get it at Circle K, 7-Eleven. I mean, this is, and it surprises them. And they go, whoa, and the people clap and everything. They go, man, we're not in Kansas anymore. So my question is, aside from all of that, who is your opposition? I mean, when you do this stuff, we got people Border Patrol agents even mention that, you know, all this problem would go away if we did away with the drug war. You know, we'd have a lot better health care. We'd have a lot better, you know, our liberties would be protected. We wouldn't, you know, be spending all this money. You have guys in wars, and whether it's funding terror, I mean, on and on and on and on and on. Anybody wearing a badge says this, boom, you're gone. Who are you up against? What is this force?
Well, I think it's, first off, it's misnomer. I mean, the fact that people have bad information and stuff like that. We have the effect of the true believer. You know, you're in it. You're doing it every day. You know, most of our law enforcement members at LEAP are retired or former law enforcement. They aren't people that are still on the job. We're drawing people that are still on the job because we're creating an organization that can make them comfortable because we only stay on the one issue, and that's the issue of prohibition. But it's still difficult for them. Let me give you the best example I can give you about my old profession. 5 years after I retired, my old boss, the chief, retired from my department. Good friend of mine. We worked with each other for years. He's the guy that promoted me to captain and, you know, so on and so forth. 6 months after he retired, I was back in town. And I called him on the phone. I said, you want some company? He says, yeah, stop over. So I stop over at the house, and we're sitting there on, you know, living room chatting. And I'm in the middle of a sentence, and I look at his face, and I see what we used to call when I was on the job, the look. And we'd be at a staff meeting. We'd all be talking. You'd look down at the head of the table. You'd see the chief's face. You'd see this look, and everybody'd shut up because you knew he was going to say something. So I was in the middle of a sentence, and I stopped, and I said, what, Ted? And he said, how long you and I have been arguing about this drug legalization garbage years? And I said, well, we've known each other for about 25 years. I guess we've been arguing about it for about 25 years. Because I felt I'm the definition of the word hypocrite. I felt this way about this issue before I got on the job. And I'll get more to that later. But back to the chief. And he looks at me and he says, how long? I said, 25 years. He says, you're right. I said, I'm what? He said, you're right. And then he said it. He said, I don't know if it's the old forest for the trees thing, but I'm not responsible for it anymore, and I have a chance to look at it for just what it is. Not for my job, but just what it is. And then he actually choked a little bit, and he said, we're killing ourselves with this, aren't we? And he meant the business, law enforcement. And I said, yeah, Ted, that's what I do. So I think there's a lot of that. You're caught up in it. This is what you believe you're supposed to do. The Gonzales firing, that had to do with all the way back to Richard Nixon. I have this image in my head of sitting around the White House and saying, you know, we need something to really get people's attention. How about this drug problem? Yeah, well, let's do something about that. Okay, well, we'll really make an effort on the drug thing. What are we going to call this? We have to have a new program. What are we going to call it? And I have this image. This is in my own mind. This is not anything that I know about or anything like that. I'm just making this up. But I have this idea that somebody at that table said, how about we call it the new prohibition? At which point everybody said, no, don't use that word. Everybody knows that doesn't work. That's a bad word. And then somebody else said, what if we call it the drug war? And that changed the whole dynamic. Because in a situation, if you're dealing with bad policy and you want to change bad policy, nobody calls that surrender or giving up. We call that a correction. But when you talk about ending a war without a victory, we call that a loss. We call that surrender. And when you use the word war, you get those terminologies then, because people use the war metaphors when they answer you when they talk about it. They don't do that with prohibition. Everybody knows that's a stupid idea. That's part of it. Also, you have the vested interests of the pharmaceutical industries and so on and so forth that we know that are investing in this stuff and stuff like that that we've seen over time. They've been at the forefront of it. You have gangsters and thugs that don't want this market. I mean, Al Capone wasn't real happy in 33, not just because he was sitting in prison, but because when he got out of prison, he didn't have his old job to go back to because we gave that to legitimate business people and decided to have a regulated marketplace for alcohol rather than a prohibitionary marketplace for alcohol. So I'm sure that there's money being invested by the drug warrior, the drug villains who want to keep this thing going because that keeps their money flowing in. Plus, you have a lot of people that we don't consider, we don't even have on our screen as villains, bankers that are laundering money, all this stuff. They're perfectly happy with this. Moralists who think that they have a right and government has a right to tell people what they should do in the privacy of their own home, they're big on this. They think it's a terrible thing if you talk about legalizing drugs. Parents who haven't looked at it, who think that if you say legalization of drugs, that you're condoning drugs, and what kind of a message does that send to children? So you get those people that are you know, they just can't let go of it. A lot of misinformation. You know, we had for 150 years in this country, women were not allowed to vote. Now, in 1920, women didn't become intelligent enough to vote. That isn't why they got the right to vote. They were always intelligent enough. It just took 150 years to educate the men in this country, us, that women should have the right to vote. Now, that didn't become a right idea. It was always a right idea. It just took a long time to change it.
Well, this is my point. You know, you have a all these different segmented groups that have their own special interests, be it, you know, because I love the children's, or I, you know, this, or make my, you know, on and on and on. And a lot of the political arguments that people would make, you know, those were generated. That wasn't a position that people initially just took. It had to be marketed. You know, it's like the new one, most recent one, was the you're funding terrorists. And I'm going, you want to stop funding terrorists and the prohibition, you stupid people. And, you know, so it just, you're funding terrorists. Every time you buy a bag of weed, you're funding terrorists. Now, yeah, the CIA. So I'm like, it comes from somewhere. There's a drumbeat. It's like a drumbeat to the drug war. And I'm wondering where it originates. I mean, because it doesn't happen. It doesn't get penetrated into the lamestream media, the media so last century, unless there's somebody that goes, yes, that be the new catchphrase. Say it as often as possible. I got it on my bullet point 3x5 card sent to me from the Uber King of whatever. And I'm wondering who the king of whatever is. I mean, where is this originating from?
Well, I can't actually, and I've been doing this for a long time, I can't actually give you a pinpoint and say if you go to 375 Elm Street and go to apartment B, you'll find the guy. But there's a lot of it out there. I mean, there's just a lot of misinformation. What you mentioned before, we at LEAP, as you well know, we at LEAP are not marijuana legalizers. I mean, obviously, if we get our point, marijuana will be legalized because there will not be any prohibition anymore, okay? But that isn't our issue. We don't fight for the drugs. And when you mentioned before, legalize heroin, what are you, crazy? One of our members, a retired police chief from down in Florida named Jerry Cameron, he has a wonderful response to that. He said, it's real easy. Whichever drug you once sold on the street corners of your community by 13 and 14-year-old children, you keep that drug illegal, and if enough people want it, that's who will be selling it on your street corners. And that's why we at LEAP are not about the drugs. If anybody is listening to the show, wants my advice about drugs, drugs are bad, don't use drugs, they're terrible, the world's a beautiful place to look at with clear eyes, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, don't do drugs. This isn't about the drugs. This is about, as you well know, the crime and violence that is generated because we've made a bad policy choice, and I want to add a word here, again. Because the only difference between alcohol prohibition and this prohibition is the things we're prohibiting. The process is exactly the same. And I was very, I've been in this movement. I retired in 1989, so I've been doing this stuff ever since I've retired because, well, as I said before, I came to my conclusion about this drug policy when I was about 21, 22 years old, when I, after studying, after watching The Untouchables and being brought up by two parents that were alive during alcohol prohibition. Both of them were born in 1904 and lived in Buffalo, New York, and I got a real interesting thing. I read everything I could get my hands on about alcohol prohibition. My wonderful Baptist mother, I would say to her, why didn't it work? And she would say, because the people didn't support it. And my fallen Catholic father, I would ask him, why didn't it work? And he would say, because it was a stupid idea when they thought of it. By the time I got to be about 20, 21 years old, the impact of the fact that we had passed a constitutional amendment to enact alcohol prohibition kind of weakened my mother's argument because there was obviously a lot of support for it and made my father's look stronger. Once I realized that my father was right, it was just a terrible idea. You know what the very first prohibition was that we have any record of?
Making money.
No, this goes way back, and it started with these words. It's also the first example of zero tolerance. And the words that started the first prohibition were, do not eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. I'm sure you've heard that before.
Oh, yeah.
Little place called the Garden of Eden. There was only two people who had to be watched. There was only one tree of knowledge, and the cop was the creator. Now, that prohibition should have worked, but it didn't. And if you read that story in Genesis, it tells you why that prohibition and every prohibition since then has failed. And that is because, according to that story, the Creator granted something to the creation, and that was called free will. And that free will still exists, even though we try to legislate it away. What we are talking about when we talk about capital P prohibition is the prohibition of consensual adult activity. When you have activities between consenting adults that they choose to do with each other, and you prohibit it, you create crime in your society. Because you had an activity where the people doing it, nobody was complaining, everybody was happy, nobody was calling the police or anything, and now all of a sudden you make this illegal. And if there's money involved in this activity, you create violence in your society because the people involved in that money transfer do not have access to the civil courts to settle disputes, so they settle them on the streets with violence.
Now, this is all, it makes such great sense and logic, and I think... if not the majority, certainly a significant minority, enough people know this. Just like they knew it during Prohibition, just like they knew it, you know, they know. That's why it just fell just out of, it wasn't for lack of trying. I mean, you know, the Ken Burns series on PBS, I DVR'd it and watched the three-part series on Prohibition, and he obviously came from the slant, this is just stupid. And emphasized it at every level, and everybody knew it, and it wasn't for lack of trying. It was the same kind of crap we're putting in now. It increased the resources to law enforcement. It became, you know, we're going to rule you because you need to be ruled, and the people that they, the same argument, same thing, and it's almost like a playbook that they knew how to manipulate the moral majority, minority, moral somebody out there and say, you know, we need to rise up against the evils of. And so here they come, and they make it a voting block, and they do, I mean, blah, 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 blah. I see that. You know, that's, you know, I'm looking at, you know, there has to be an enormous amount of money to be made by anyone on any side of that. You know, this is what happens. I'll give you a good example. When Sheriff Arpaio first became sheriff here in Arizona in 1992, long time ago, he comes in, he's ex-DEA. I mean, I know how to get it, you know, third world country dictator, kind of, you know, got gun and badge and roadblock and put a bubble over Maricopa County and check all the cars coming in and out, and boom, we shut it down, let's do it. Well, then, of course, that Constitution thing got in the way and politics and everybody complained and so on. But, you know, he was perfectly willing to do that. Now, what happened was, you know, it becomes, as time goes on, you know, it was obvious to a lot of us libertarians, you know, but, you know, it was just, you know, hey, I need somebody to, you know, protect my interest in my business. I'm Mr. Big Kingpin Drug Dealer. And you go to who? You go to law enforcement. You know, you don't need blood in the streets. You just go, hey, man, this guy's selling drugs in my hood. I mean, in my area, in my territory, in my whatever. And go, he's bad. Go arrest him. Get all his stuff. Eliminate my competition. Then you start to find out that, heck, law enforcement is not only paid to look the other way, paid to go and arrest certain people. So this is, the government is so deeply involved in this. And you have enormous amount of resources. It funds a bunch of covert stuff. We went through this with the MENA, Arkansas, and the, you know, drug running that went on when we're taking stuff down to Nicaragua, and empty planes are, you know, very useful to fill up on the way back. And all this stuff, I'm going, I get it. Now tell me, what are you doing that is finally going, I mean, is it really just education of the people, or is there an end game to where it's finally going to have to be somebody's got to go to jail? And it's the people that are part of this corruption at the very top. But they made corruption legal, and they're so insulated. I mean, it's like you have to have a revolution. So I need to know what the end game is going to be on this.
Well, the end game is, first off, it's going to take some time again, and I know you hate to hear it, Ed, because I hate to hear it, too. When I retired and I got into this work, I said this is the first thing in my life that I honestly look at, and I think I may do for the rest of my life and never see the success of my work, because I know how long these things take. Part of the problem, and I'm mentioning Sheriff Arpaio, it's very interesting. We have the largest prison population on the planet. We have one of the most efficient prison systems and jail systems on the planet. Hardly ever do you hear of anybody escaping from one of our prisons. We put you in there, you're there. And we do not have in that system, or does Sheriff Arpaio, have one drug-free prison in America. Not even Sheriff Arpaio can keep the drugs out of his jails. Okay, so if you can't keep drugs out of prison, who is going to be delusional enough to think you can keep them out of a free society? That's the one aspect of this thing. The other aspect is, and I want to make an apology to you from the drug policy reform movement, which I've been involved with since 1989. And that apology is this. We in this movement have spent too much time on marijuana and not any time or very little time on ending prohibition. When you watch that Ken Burns series, for anybody that didn't see it, as you just mentioned, it was 6 hours. The first 2 hours were about the lead up to prohibition. The second 2 hours were about the period of prohibition. And then the last 2 hours were about the repeal of prohibition. If you noticed, in that last 2 hours, not one person that was calling for the repeal of alcohol prohibition wanted it repealed because alcohol was really okay. You know, it's wonderful stuff. You should give it to your kids. It's got medical uses. None of that. They only argued about the failure of the policy of prohibition. In this movement today, the only group that argues purely on that issue is LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And we didn't start this in this movement until 2002. So all the time before that has been spent on medical marijuana, trying to change people's minds about marijuana, all this other stuff. And where are we? It took 13 years to end the first prohibition. We've been arguing about this one for 60 years, and we're still at the same place we were before. So part of the problem, that why this hasn't changed, is because we haven't brought the proper message to the people. What you said before is true. In fact, sometimes I'll be in front of a Rotary Club or a Kiwanis Club, or whatever group, Chamber of Commerce, and sometimes I'll start my presentation by saying something you said just a few minutes ago, and that was, I am not going to tell you one thing here today that you do not already know. And that is the truth. I don't use statistics. I don't use that. I just talk about the failure of the policy of prohibition and what problems it causes in our society. You know, if you said the word prohibition to the average American in 1919, their response was, what a great idea. It's going to save America from demon rum. If you said the word prohibition in 1934 to the average American, they would have said, what a stupid idea. Whoever thought of that? Same concept. The only difference was 13 years of it being done. This is a failed policy. And, you know, when you were asking me before about who are the people? I divide our species into two categories. You know, a good friend of mine always said that's right. There are only two kinds of our species. There's the kind of people that think you can divide us into two categories, and the kind of people that are smarter than that. Okay, so I realize that we're much more complex than that. But for this conversation, these are the two categories. I call them the normal people and the fascists. And here's my definition of the word fascist. First, I'll give you the normal people. If you're a normal person and you have a great new idea, what you do is you actualize it. And if other people admire it, you share it with them. Now, I'm a capitalist, so you may share it for a profit, but you share it with them. If you're a fascist and you have a great new idea, the next thought that comes into your head is, this is such a good idea, we ought to make everybody do it this way. And the problem is we have a lot of fascists out there, and they aren't in the fascist party. Some of them are Republicans, some of them are Democrats, some of them are even libertarians, some of them are even anarchists. But there's those people, those kind of us people, who think that because they think something is right, they have a right to make other people do it that way. Those are the people that are at the root of this stuff, and they're going to be with us forever. Now, they're not a majority, but they're a very vocal minority, and sometimes they get their way, and when they get it, it lasts for a long time. Just because something lasts a long time doesn't mean it's a good idea. It just means it don't, you know, slavery was a stupid idea from the get-go. Not only was it dumb morally, but economically. It's much more sensible for me to buy 40 hours a year time than it is for me to owe you. That's too expensive.
See, all this is, it's great conversation. You do a really good job at it, and it's been, you know, 20 years for you, and we're at a position now that the conversation I want to have, I'm like, there has to be people that you have got to the level that it's not about convincing them how bad this is. It's about convincing them how inevitable it is that it must change. But
right.
The thing is that they're in positions. Somebody is encouraging this. Somebody allows this. Somebody supports this. Somebody enables this. And I'm going, I mean, you know, quit hacking at the branches, man. Start striking at the root. And I need to know where the root is.
I think the problem is exactly that. It is hard to find the root, because every time you go to grab one thing you think is the root, then another thing pops up over here. It's kind of like trying to do away with drugs, because there's so much vested interest on both sides. According to the UN 2 years ago, they looked at the worldwide illegal drug trade, and they said it's a $500 billion a year industry. A half a trillion dollar a year industry is the illegal drug trade. Now, you tell a good capitalist that there's $500 billion laying out there, but don't touch it because we might put you in jail if we catch you. I mean, you're not going to dissuade anybody from that. So you got a lot of people that are in it. Some people are in it for very short periods of time. You know, one of the comments I get from people all the time is, do you think if we legalize drugs that the gangsters will just become honest people? And my answer is no. The gangsters will say gangsters. But just like any other illegal trade like this, most of the people, the vast number of people that are involved in this trade, are not what you would call gangsters, but are opportunists. They are people that see an opportunity to make a quick buck, and they take it, and they move on. And those people, they're hard to nail down, and we do occasionally. Look at how many drug czars drug kingpins we've busted.
Competition!
You know?
Competition for somebody else. You know, that's all it comes down to.
That's all we do. We say at LEAP that every drug arrest creates a job opening that is filled instantly. And that is the simple reality of it. I came into police work, like I said, I made my decision about this drug war before I became a cop. So, you know, I sat myself down before I put the badge on. And I said, look, at everything you know about this is theory. Now you're actually going to be working it, doing it. Put all your old thinking on the back burner. Give it a fair shot. And by the time I was on the job, about 4.5 years, I came to the conclusion that I was right when I walked in the door. And here's the reason why, and this was from personal experience, not theory. It was the only aspect of our job that no matter how vigorously I or my brother and sister officers did the job, it didn't make any difference. All that changed was the faces on the people we arrested.
Of course it made a difference. It got enormous amounts of resources going. They're the local police now with military equipment.
That's another bad aspect of this drug war is we have blended military and police training together. When you have a society like ours is designed to be, your police academy should be on the East Coast and your military academy should be on the West Coast. That's how far apart they should be. And we haven't done that. We've blended them together. There's a reason why the Posse Comitatus Act exists, because we understood the threat of using military force against our own citizens. But now we're turning our police departments into military units with this drug war. War. This is a war we're at.
It's an excuse to do war on our liberties, war on controlling us, war on making money, war for the prison complex, war for... I mean, this is, you know, nobody benefits from a war more than the state. And the state has benefited way too freaking much. And I've talked about LEAP for many years. I've had, you know, representatives on. We've talked about this over the years of my radio programs, various different places, and when producing, I've had you on for host. I'm doing. I mean, I promote a lot of the work that you do on my websites. I mean, we're all over it. And I'm telling you, it's getting to the point to where we need to start going at. Is there a group out there saying, yeah, this some bitch and politician right freaking there is the scumbag piece of crap that needs to be targeted? I mean, actually going out doing something kind of like a JPFO or Girls of America targeting politicians, because that's one thing that I don't get that Leap does. I mean, that's probably not your thing, but I mean, I'm looking for somebody that, you know, let's take some of these guys out. And the best that we can come up with is Dr. Paul up there going, you know, this is a drug war bad. I mean, and he's doing a great job, and all of a sudden it's blindsiding the Republican base and the leadership and finding how freaking popular his position is on quit having all of this coercion, and I need a target. I already know. I want to know where the target. I want to support the people that are got somebody in their sights. I want, it's like Institute for Justice that's out suing people. Electronic Frontier Foundation that are suing people. I, you know, Leap, when we have these gentlemen, they lose their jobs and so on, and then it's great that you guys give them attention and everything. But I need to know, we're past that. Let's go whip some ass, man.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I had kind of misguided, as usual, when it comes to politics, but I had kind of high hopes for our current president because of the things he said before he came into office.
Fibber.
And now we're seeing some of the most atrocious things being done to these marijuana grow operations and medical marijuana things, using the IRS now to shut them down. And that's under the Obama administration.
Okay, now let's focus on that for a minute, because that was one of the, you know, little fine silver thread lining on his inauguration, was that he was making the promises that he wasn't going to do exactly what he's doing.
Exactly.
And I'm going, which is a big giant, you know, shock. But the point is, I'm going, for someone to do that, run for president of the United States, you know, the quote leader of the free world, you know, gag me with a forklift. So when we have this individual gets in on that promise, elected on that promise, whether it's a war in the Middle East, it's this, it's what, and then all of a sudden, without hesitation, just renege on the whole thing.
Yep.
That has to come from somewhere. It keeps getting smaller and smaller of a club of people that we can blame for this, and Leap needs to get, you know, me all motivated and let's go whip some ass, and against what? I'm educated up, man.
It's sometimes it's bigger than one person, you know, and it's the old, we used to satisfy ourselves back, you know, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago with a little thing that they used to call the scapegoat. And we would pick out one of the goats and we would put all the problems that we're having in our village on it, and we'd kick the goat out of the village and that would be the end of our problems and we'd think everything was solved. Of course it wasn't, because it's human nature that drives these things. You get to be an elected official. I had a guy come up to me up in New Hampshire about 5 years ago, and I was at a Rotary Club, and he walks up to me at the end, off to the side, and he says, you know, I agreed with everything you had to say here today. This is terrible and everything, but if I'm an elected state official, he said, if I run on this issue, they could beat me with a dead one-legged dog. Okay, now that's the attitude in the elected officialdom out there.
No, it's, you know, this is my point. I, you know, this, maybe that would have been true in the past and so on. And
I understand.
Dr. Paul is showing just how much BS that is, because what they're coming, and I've run for office a lot. I've been involved in 20 plus years. I get it. And they come in, they'll say, oh no, you can't get elected on, can't get elected. No, it's not that you don't have the support of the people. It's not that you can't get the vote. It's not that you, there's something else. And it's not the people. It's the machine. It's the press. It's the media. It's the leadership. It's the election computers. I mean, it's whatever, but it's something else.
Well, it's interesting when you say that, because when you think of the drug war, just looking at it, you know, quick look, the past 40 years, whatever, if you were going to pick a political party that you would think that you could blame for most of this stuff, it would be the Republicans, those conservatives. They would. But in reality, the loudest voice that comes for legalization is coming out of the Republican Party, because the conservatives get it quicker than the liberals do. It's a good friend of mine is an addiction psychiatrist up here in Syracuse, and he says, we have left-right liberal, conservative, red, blue, whatever you want to call it. Actually, what we have is two parents. One's ma, one's dad. The liberals are ma. I'll take care of you. Everything will be okay. Everything will be fine. And the Democrats are dad. Pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. Do it on your own. And dad gets it much quicker than ma does, that what you're doing to yourself is your business, not the state's.
No, it's okay? A game. It's a game they play. It's exactly that. You got, you know, Obama plays one side. McCain right? played the other. And they'll go, oh, and we'll do this and elect us if you want. And it's just a flavor. It's chocolate vanilla, man. I mean, it doesn't make any difference.
You got Gary Johnson, also another Republican candidate. He's also been speaking for legalization for some time.
And they have blacked him out as much as they
can.
Here is a guy that, you know, I don't even vote anymore. I've had, you know, I'm done. You know, you're still voting. I mean, seriously.
But I still vote because I just can't not do it.
It's, I vote every time I put a sign up, every time I do
yep,
it.
Yep, you know, absolutely.
I'm because we work. Okay, I don't know if you know this. The audience knows, but just so you for our conversation, the Ron Paul Revolution logo, that Levolution logo. I'm the one that created that.
Oh, cool.
So we started the Ron Paul Levolution here in Phoenix, and it mm-hmm. just and I traveled all over the country. I was a butt buster for Ron Paul, but I don't vote. I vote with the signs. I vote with that meme. I vote with the yep. concept. I vote with changing people's minds, freeing their minds. That's my vote because I will not put the expression that I have that I want to articulate and I want to do my education or my advocacy or whatever. I'm not going to put it in the hands of some computer program, you know, debold machine, and they say that's what, you know, screw them. I don't trust them. So now we're in this situation to where we're having politics as an opportunity to change minds. And who was a really good opportunity to do that? Here comes Gary Johnson, a former governor reelected in New Mexico that mm-hmm. vetoed 700 and something bills. I mean, oh, my goodness, more than everybody else put together, maybe throughout history. I mean, amazing, amazing. Balancing budgets, you know, in the drug. I remember when he came here to Arizona and spoke with the governors of California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, all the border states, came here for something at the Arizona State Capitol building. He got him said, end the freaking drug war. And everybody freaked out. And I'm going, here's a guy that, you know, has the credentials that would you would love to have him up there on the podium. Hell no. Hell no. And I'm going, yeah, who makes these decisions?
And a self-made businessman on top of it, by the way, Gary Johnson.
Yep, who makes these decisions?
Yeah, well, actually, ultimately, we all do, right, when we vote. Isn't that the concept?
No, you're not allowed to even vote for him. You're not allowed to hear what he has to say. You're not allowed to support him. You're not allowed. Who makes that decision?
You may want to adopt my position, but I don't know where you classify yourself politically, but I call myself a hardcore Marxist. Now, I'm not talking about Karl. I'm talking about Groucho. Groucho Marx always said that he would never join any organization that would have someone like him as a member.
No, I'm familiar with that one. I'm hip to that.
Right. And that's my fundamental political philosophy. So I'm an independent. I'm not a member of any party. I vote for what I don't even vote for a position because there's nobody that I would give my vote to. But I go to a voting booth because I think and this is just a personal opinion. I just feel it's my obligation as a citizen to do that. So I do it. But whether I feel good about it or not, no, I don't. I feel like it. I feel like I'm wasting my time and energy, but I just can't stop myself from doing it. But things will change. I mean, look at the biggest issue on this thing, and every attorney I talk to tells me I'm crazy, the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause, they can't do this. In order to give the Commerce Clause the authority to ban the interstate transportation of alcohol, we had to first grant it the power by making an amendment to the Constitution to give them the power.
They don't care about that anymore.
I know. The only thing the Commerce Clause does is give the federal government the right to regulate interstate commerce, not prohibit. But yet, it goes on doing that, and nobody's even fighting it in the courts.
Yeah, you
nobody's
know what?
Even bringing the question up.
You know, prohibition is a big, giant regulation. That's what they're going to say.
Well,
you know, this is the one thing of the Constitution. I'm not even a Constitution fan. I'm a big declare your independence with Ernest Hancock. I mean, that's the name of the show. I'm a Declaration of Independence kind of guy. Bill of Rights don't suck either, okay?
Right.
But I tell you, It was the compromise that the libertarians made back in the day to even allow them to have this Constitution thing without another freaking revolution. They go, yeah, I need a whole bunch of 10 thou shalt nots of government. You better get scribbling, buddy, or, you know, heck no. Patrick Henry's going 4 hours to legislature. Don't ratify this thing. I see what they're doing, this centralized government. You get this, you know, legislative, executive, and judicial off in the corner conspiring against the individual, and you wind up in a free speech zone. That's what happens. So I'm going, I get it. They'll use Butler Schaefer, a law professor, you know, that I'm good friends with. He's always making the point that he goes, look, man, it doesn't matter what the Constitution says when you give the government the ability to interpret it. Guess what?
Right.
They're going to interpret it however the hell they want. And they have. We did in Arab Spring, it's a long story, but we were supporting a lot of the revolutionaries, you know, no violence kind of stuff in Arabia. And we're sending them, Cato had translations in English and Arabic of the Declaration of Independence, Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. Well, in a little mailing label over the Constitution page where it started, we had to write in Arabic, we already tried, maybe you can do better. I mean, you know, I am not endorsing this Constitution thing because it's just another plantation for your mind. It was a way to control you. And the Commerce Clause and all these other clauses, it's just the whole idea, we're going to rule you better, but we're going to rule you. And if you got somebody saying they're going to rule you, you get drug wars and you get all the corruption and the death. And in Mexico right now, you have no mas blood, man. They got that whole campaign. Tell me what you know about that. And Mexico, you got mothers. They got tens of thousands of people being killed in mass graves. The drug war is causing mass homicide there. Hell, you almost want to say genocide. You got all this death going on, and moms are in the street saying, no mas, no mas, no mas.
Right.
What's happening in Mexico?
Well, they're at least getting some discussion. The president's even, who was came in as a staunch drug warrior and really kicked off all this stuff that is pushing now and causing all these deaths and creating all this activity. And it's again a stark but stupid idea. You know, just because we're a highly educated, sophisticated country doesn't mean that we can't do profoundly stupid things. To give you a perfect example, in the 1920s, one of the most highly sophisticated cultures in Europe was a place called Germany, okay? And they got swayed into that whole Nazi garbage stuff. So we have to be constantly watching that. You mentioned the Bill of Rights. The first eight are interesting and all that. My favorite one is the Ninth Amendment. And Scalia, when asked about the Ninth Amendment, the Supreme Court Justice, when asked about the Ninth Amendment, said it's a joke. And if anybody doesn't know, what the Ninth Amendment basically says, and I'm paraphrasing this, but we've articulated in the previous eight amendments other rights that people have, but that doesn't mean that there aren't a whole bunch of rights that people have that we haven't articulated. So just because we haven't specifically said the right to doesn't mean you don't have the right to. You do under the Ninth Amendment. But we have a Supreme Court justice that thinks that would be a medical marijuana thing, for instance, the right to self-medicate.
Well, that was the argument that they made by even doing the Bill of Rights. The other side, they'll say, if you go listing them, then they'll think that this is it, you know?
Right.
And they go, no, 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 and here it is. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And so then you left it open. Okay, well, what are those? Oh, it's whatever, you know, the heck I want, pursuit of happiness. I mean, you know, and I get to determine that, not the government. So the fact that you even create a government, a coercive government, the government with these kind of powers that has taken away, you know, the state sovereignty, and they militarize all the local law enforcement, and they put us all, I remember in the 90s when this was starting, we were all screaming against this multi-jurisdictional task force thing. Well, now they call them fusion centers under Homeland Security. You got the Occupy groups that are going around with Central Command Authority with all their new toys from the Pentagon, telling them to do whatever, and now they're coming out with lasers. You know, lasers, you know, to blind you, and then they got these sonic weapons. They got all kind of, I mean, it's just, we control you. You're our freaking pets. You're our livestock. You know?
Hey,
and if you're really good, you're our vampire familiars or pet. You know,
when are you going to start having local police departments having drones? When's that going to happen?
It's already started.
You know?
No, they have them in Texas right now. We just had a story on Freedom's Phoenix yesterday that they used a Predator drone to capture some, I don't know, somebody that was holed up, separatist kind of whatever bad guys. They called in the drones, and here they go. Here we go. It's already started. They got helicopters with this $500,000, you know, patrol seeing in the sky helicopter, sheriff in Texas. I mean, it's already started. You know what? There was any doubt? I mean, it's like a proving ground all around the world for them to bring it here. And they go, well, they wouldn't bring it here. What are you, stupid? Of course they would.
The first time this really jumped out at me was in the early 70s. When we in law enforcement started using a thing called civil forfeiture.
Yeah.
And
Making some money.
As soon as I saw that, now, in case anybody doesn't know exactly what that is, there's two types of forfeiture that law enforcement uses. There's criminal forfeiture, which means that I arrest you for a crime, I charge you, and I convict you of that crime. And once you're convicted of that crime, I keep all the property you had from the profits of that crime that I seized in the beginning, and the government keeps it because you were a criminal and that was criminally accepted. Under civil forfeiture, I don't have to arrest you for anything. I just take your property away. You decide that you're going to come to visit Peter Christ out on the west coast or out on the east coast, and you're going to need some cash, so you take $10,000 and you put $10,000 in your pocket, and when you go to the airport, they search you and they find the money, and they say that they think you're doing this to buy drugs, so they seize your money, and you have to sue them to get the money back and prove that you weren't going to buy drugs with that money in order to get the money back. That's called civil forfeiture. No arrest, no charge. In fact, what a better word for that instead of civil forfeiture is theft.
Highway robbery. King's Men.
Theft. Exactly.
Same exact thing.
And the only difference is law enforcement is doing it. If that was happening in any other country in the world, we would be saying, what are those people, crazy? That's not it. If any other country in the world had their prison population working for private industry, or if any other country in the world had privately run prisons so that they turned prisons into a profit-making operation, we would say there's something wrong for that, and we do that here in America.
Tell me about some jurisdictions where they have a an incentive. You do RICO seizures. You got your property. The law, individual law enforcement, certainly the departments now, but individual law enforcement, they get a cut.
Chiefs of police have been told by the communities they work for when their budgets are cut that they should get the rest of the money from forfeiture. So we're turning, in fact, I retired from the PD in 89, and we started our own drug unit 6 months after I retired. Now, the reason they didn't have one before that is every time somebody mentioned anything at a staff meeting about a drug unit, there was this one crazy captain there who would say, "That we don't need to do that. Our job is to protect these people from each other. There's plenty of drug." That was me. When I left, they got a drug unit. And as soon as they got the drug unit, they started doing forfeiture stuff and bringing money in. And I was back in town visiting, and I said, "You know, you guys really gave me a rotten deal. What are you talking about?" I said, "Why? If you would have told me that 6 months after I retired you were going on commission, I might have stayed, because police work is a great job. But if you can do it on commission, hell, it's really a great job then."
No.
But that's the kind of insanity that we are doing. You know, it's these officers that are being fired for even suggesting that they disagree with the policy, or for signing something that they disclaimer it, but still in all they fire them for these things. Those are the kind of things you do when you have a failed policy and you're trying to make it seem like it's working.
So now let's get the end game here. I mean, your LEAP offers what? I mean, you have individuals such as yourself that are able to go out and educate people and do interviews and participate.
I'll tell you the best thing.
What is it you do that is the most impactful? And how many people are in LEAP, and how many active people are actually, you know, doing what you're doing?
Okay. We have roughly 50,000 people on our mailing list at this point. That's everybody. Roughly 2,500 of them are people from law enforcement, and about 150 of them are people that we have that are willing to go out and speak to any group, whatever. Here's the big thing we bring to this issue. If you have a drug warrior in your community, I don't care if it's a judge, a DEA, a sheriff, or whatever, and they want to debate the drug issue, we at LEAP will send a matching unit to debate them. You got a judge, we'll put a judge at the other podium. You got a DEA guy, we'll put a DEA guy at the other podium. You got a state trooper, we'll put a state trooper at the other podium. No longer is the argument between a bunch of crazy hippies that want to legalize drugs and the people that think that they got to protect the world from drugs. That isn't the debate. And in fact, we're not going to stand there and defend any of these drugs at all. So when the other side argues that these drugs are bad, we're going to say, you know what, you're right. In fact, these drugs are so bad, they are so dangerous, that they must be regulated and controlled. And the reality is our current policy is a policy of total deregulation and decontrol of this dangerous drug marketplace. We have turned this whole thing over to gangsters, thugs, and children on our streets rather than licensed business people.
I don't even want them licensed business people. I don't even have to be licensed. I mean, it's like regulating ragweed, man. I mean, you know, how are you going to do that without having the same problems?
Well, yeah, I understand that, but there always is some form of regulation, whether it's formal,
it's called
informal.
Mom and dad. It's called when you do somebody else harm. It's called when you damage my goodies.
Well, it's like the herbal marketplace in this country. The herbal marketplace is totally unregulated by the federal government. You can sell any herbs you want. Now, if you're mixing rat poison with the herb and killing people, we're going to arrest you for that because that's rat poison you're selling to people, okay, and not telling them.
Yeah, if they want to go and say, heck, let me tell you what would be my dream day is when the government is arresting somebody for selling marijuana because it wasn't as potent as what he was promising on the label.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, when you're committing fraud, man. This isn't purple kush. This is, you know, ditch weed. You know,
right, exactly.
So
exactly.
I mean, you know, when you get down to that, then you got a government that's actually doing what's supposed to is preventing force and fraud. And I'm going, that's what I'm shooting for. And the only way to get there is to change the culture. But the culture, I'm seeing that it's no longer that it's get to. You can see where this is going. It's going to be to the point that the culture is going just by the demise and the older ages just starting to, you know, fade out as a new generation's coming up and access to information and being, you know, plugged in, logged on, whatever. They just know. But it doesn't matter. There's going to be a few people at the top with the shiny badge and the gun and the positions of power that control everything that go, no, we're going to do what we want to do the way we want to do it. And you're our livestock. Sit down and shut the F up. And I'm going, wow, what happens then?
Can I give you a quick little thing about this? And this is something I've been talking about for a number of years now. Back in the 1500s, there was a guy that lived over in Germany called Gutenberg. And Gutenberg is a guy that brought movable type to the Europeans. And he started printing Bibles and leaflets and stuff like that. And that Gutenberg stuff, that printing press, was the beginning of the demise of the power of the church and the power of the king over the everyday people. Because up until that point, books had to be transcribed by hand. They were too expensive for anybody to have them, and they were too expensive to let out. So the king or the church said, the book says this, go do it, and that was it. Now when Gutenberg started giving everybody books, people started reading the books, and they would look at, like Luther looked at the Pope and said, you know, you said the book says this, but when I read it, it says this. I think that we today live during another period of Gutenberg, and it's the internet now. We actually live for the first time on this planet as a species where if you do not know something, it's your fault because the information is out there. Now, I know there's a lot of crap out there and you got to be discerning.
Yeah, but what happened to Martin Luther, man?
Right, exactly. You got to separate the wheat from the chaff and everything. But I think that what you're kind of talking about is what's coming, but it's going to take a long time. For it to evolve through, it'll happen quicker than it did in the 1500s because there's so much more information flying around. But I think that this internet thing is taking, and I think that this internet thing is the demise of the nations and the states as we know them.
Yeah, they're going to become the internet, and they'll try and shut it down, close it, regulate it.
Oh, yeah,
that's what they're
absolutely.
Already starting to do that. But all that does is just foster internet, 2.0, 15.0,
exactly.
57.0. And I mean, we'll start putting. That's why we were so behind this privatization of space, and from the beginning, I mean, we were at the first mm-hmm. launch with Burt Rutan back in June of 2004, and we go, you know what? We're going to space, and government's not invited. And we're just going, yep. I already know what's going to happen. We're going to have our own communication satellites. We're going to have our own internet bypass the whole system. We have Richard Branson out there already advocating buying up all these defunct, bankrupt communication satellites so he can give internet access to the poor children in third world. Yeah, right.
Yep.
So I'm going, we're already there. And I'm just, there. But at the end of this, there are going to be people with the unlimited resources, which is getting limited. They thought it was a bottomless bucket. And this derivative thing and the economy, what they've done, and all of this banking, the Federal Reserve, they're finding out, you know what? It's limited, and it's limited yep. value of paper. And it's going to get to the point to where you don't have some marijuana to trade, well, then you go hungry.
yep.
So this is I see where this is going. And I'm my thing is, I wanted to talk to you. We have Peter Crist on. He's co-founder and current board member of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And you started this your quest back in the late 80s. You're a retired police officer. You're a captain. A small town right outside of Buffalo. And mm-hmm. this has been an eye-opening experience, I would imagine, on many different levels as the time has gone on. But have you ever, in all your years doing this, ever had a vast number of the population understand exactly what you're talking about?
Well, as far as vast number comes up with, what I can say and what I fall back on is when I do my presentations to groups consistently, 25 to 30% at the end of the presentation sign up with LEAP. Okay? Now, that's 25-30% that are willing to stand up and sign up in front of their peers. So that's the number that I kind of use as a percentage of the ones that get it. Now, you know that there's got to be another 15-20% on top of that agree but just don't want to sign up.
No, they know it's broke. I mean, even the biggest drug warrior, war warrior on using freaking government, the war on whatever, they have to. It only worked when it was working. For them, it only mm-hmm. was okay as long as they kept the mice on the wheels. I mean, as long as they were churning the economy. When it all goes, they start to question everything. And I'm going, okay, I understand this. You just look at history. This happens over and oh, that's why they call it revolution. It just keeps coming around. So I'm going, okay. In this next revolution, there's one thing that's different than from any other time, and you alluded to it. It is the immediate light speed access to all information known to man. All you got to do is know the question. And I go, freedom's the answer. What's the freaking question? I go, let me tell you what the question is. Doesn't matter. Freedom's the answer. Yep. So I'm going, this is so going to be ingrained in us as time goes on. But we are going to be physically up against those that do not want this humanity's evolution past the need for rulers. And I'm going from being in law enforcement, police chief, who are we up against? What is the mindset? There's something that we're going to have to fight. What is it?
Well, it's like I said before, it's that part of us, that part of our species that fall into that category that I give of fascists, that they think that they have a right to force other things down. And that's good. That could be anywhere. You saw that. I mean, you met those kids in kindergarten, even before they became adults, that were the bullies that thought they could make other people do what they wanted to do. That's part of our species. We suffer from that. The thing is that at some points in time in our evolution, we've been able to marginalize those people and keep them off in the fringe, and at some other times, they shifted to power. Okay, I was just watching a thing on television about Mussolini in Color, it was called. It was about a two-hour thing about him and how he rose up in Italy and everything else. And that's what happens. It's the people that we give power to. It's I have two words I have my own definition for. The first one is fascist. The other one is liberty. And I define liberty as the right to be as stupid as you choose to be, as long as you do not harm another person or another person's property. And when I say that to people, a lot of times I get a look like, oh, you're just being cute or whatever. And I'm going, no, I'm dead serious, and I'll tell you why. Let's talk about Tom for a minute. What's Tom doing? I don't know. He's stupid. He's up on a hill over there. He thinks he's going to catch light inside a glass ball and light the world. How stupid can you be? 2 years later, what's Tom doing? He's crazy. He's out of his mind. He still thinks he's going to catch light inside a glass ball and light the world. 2 years later, did you hear about Tom? He's a genius. He caught light inside a glass ball. He's going to light the world. Tom Edison, what a great guy. Stupid, crazy genius is what runs through our history. All the great ideas that have ever come up, the first person that thought of them was labeled by everybody else as being stupid. If they persisted in that thinking, they were labeled as crazy, and the rest of us caught up, then we called them geniuses. Now, I admit that 90% of the stupid people out there are, in fact, stupid, all right? But that 10% that are going to work their way through to be geniuses, we need them. And that's why we have to put up with the stupidity. I was in a business that it was my job. I was trained to do something. And what I was trained to do was protect my fellow citizens from other citizens that were going to do them harm. That was my job, not to protect them from themselves. And that is a function of church, family, education, and the healthcare system, not the criminal justice system. But we've taken things like these drug laws and said that in order to protect people from themselves, we're going to have to criminalize their behavior, put them in prison in order to do this to make them better people. And that's the problem. It isn't people that are out there to do bad things. It's the people out there that think that the bad things are actually good things.
Okay, let me ask helping. You. I want to ask you one thing before we go in and give you an opportunity to give out web pages and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, we have another generation coming in. I'm just old enough. I'm 50 years old. I have been an activist since my mid late 20s, and I've seen it go from the older peace officer types that were like they could see the influx of, you know, some of the, they're just messed up in the head, be it they were Vietnam vets or they, the people that were, that come in, they were being marketed to, we just need, you know, law enforcers of drug war and all this other kind of stuff. And the older guys seem that they remember the days of Officer Friendly and they were a little bit more constitutionally oriented and saw the separation of the federal government and the states and local law enforcement, military and all. I mean, they grew up in a different era. But they could see what was coming, and a lot of them left. You know, they either morphed or they left. And a lot of them, they just retired out, they left, they whatever. Then you had this new crop of, you know, Gulf War I vets and Gulf War Now vets and all this kind of this. It's almost like they create these wars just to create more cops. And they come in with this attitude of who's going to kick some butt and militarize it with SWAT teams and everything, and they were kicking in doors in Afghanistan, you know, 6 months later, kicking in doors in Brooklyn. So yep. I'm going, this is, it seems that there is a march towards a fascist police force that is recruited to have a fascist police force that doesn't have their name or badges or anything. They just get a black uniform, and they go out there and kick butt by design. As you're out talking to law enforcement in the past decade or so, are you seeing this shift, or are they coming more representative of the people and leaning more towards your position, or is there a bright line between the two? They both exist. Tell me about your experience and numbers about that.
Well, I would think that, first off, when I came into police work was in 1969. 1,000 years ago, okay? And it was just in the late 60s, early 70s is when they were professionalizing police work. And for instance, I couldn't have even done, I'm a high school graduate, I never went to college. I couldn't have even got on a police department today. Because today you got to have at least 2 years of college, 4 years of college, you get on the police department. So we have people at a little bit higher educational level, whatever. We're also getting people because we feel an obligation, and I'm not saying we shouldn't. I'm a ex-Navy guy. I'm a Vietnam era veteran, not a Vietnam War veteran. Okay, But I was in during that period, and we got benefits. We took the exam to be on the police department. We got extra points if we had military in our background because we were looking to take care of those people that had gone off and you know, done work for their country in the military. So we're drawing some of those. So we're getting that. We had I worked with the Vietnam guys who were messed up in Vietnam and had to figure out ways to deal with that stuff when they came back to civilian life and stuff like that. So I know this experience. And that war experience, the wars don't make any difference. The war experience is exactly the same for everybody, no matter what war. And, you know,
how does war experience help with being a peace officer?
It doesn't, except that we hire people from that background because we feel we owe them something. Okay, so we give them a little bit more.
They want us to believe that we owe them something. Well, if we do, we sure as hell don't owe them to have a gun and pointing it at us with the same mentality that they were pointing it at somebody, other civilian.
Well, interestingly enough, I mention this often, that I was in a profession that was one of the things that made us unique is in this society, we are the only ones that are allowed to use physical force, including deadly physical force, against our own citizens. And it's interesting because in a lot of countries, that's the military that does that. But in this country, it's us. It's law enforcement. So we have to be very, very careful about how we make that blend. And sometimes we're not as careful as we should be about how we make that blend. That does worry me a little bit, but I see the educational level higher. Now, I don't know whether that's good or bad.
Indoctrination
but
level. I mean, it's just well, another word for indoctrination.
Well, they got when I got on the when I came on the job in the late '60s, we were making busts for roaches in the ashtray. Okay, by about 1971, 72, we weren't making those arrests anymore. And I don't mean just me individually; I mean pretty much in our profession. And when Nixon kicked off the drug war and stuff like that, through the 70s, it took a while to get going, there was kind of a laissez-faire attitude. By the early 80s, I saw the new guys coming on the job, and they were making single-joint busts and roach busts out of the ashtray and stuff like that, just like when I first started. So that had changed. We had gone through a mellow period in the 70s, and now we were back to the, you know, the hardcore war thing. And a lot of them, I mean, some of the ones that I argue with them, when I go back to a retirement party, the guys that came on within the last 10 years think that the work that I'm doing is the most wonderful thing I could be doing. The guys that came on the 10, you know, that have been on the job for, you know, 15, 20 years, they think that I'm a villain for the things that I'm doing. So I have some hope in the youth that they get it, that they understand that this isn't their function, that their job is to protect people from each other and not from themselves. So I think I do have some hope in in that. I also have some fear because it's there's that old line that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I disagree with the first part of that. I don't know that power always corrupts, but I'll guarantee you this. Power always intoxicates. And whether that intoxication leads to corruption or not is kind of up to the individual, but it always intoxicates. And being a cop at 3 o'clock in the morning and walking up with a gun on your hip to somebody in a car is pretty seductive. Okay, you could really be bought into it. And I had some good background training when I was a kid from my parents, so I wasn't as sucked into it as a lot of my peers were, but I saw that happen to a lot of people.
It is part of a culture. I mean, this whole mentality of, you know, the most popular game in the planet right now, already just released, and it's already over $1 billion sold, as Modern Warfare 3. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm just, and I used to go, oh, yeah, it doesn't, you know, what's the big deal? I had, you know, four kids. I mean, they're always playing whatever. But it they get so, I tell you this, where's the American Revolution 4? I mean, you know, where's the, you know, the video game, we're going to go whip butt because you guys deserve it, kind of, oh, man, you'd hear all about that, you know? So this is, it's a cultural thing, and LEAP is having a big impact on it. I know that you are, and I hammer on a lot of times when we get to this point that we're starting to educate, it gets to where you think it's done. It's really never done. But that there's going to be, at the end of this, at the end, there's always going to be the last guys standing representing the state saying, we're not going to go quietly into that good night, and we got lots of guns. And what do you got? Well, they're going to probably by then try to make sure we don't have them anymore. So this is, I'm glad you're out there doing the work that you are. And I'm just, when you got something you need really help with from, a love illusionary that's got some creativity and it's going to make a difference, certainly here in Arizona, we can target on some, go do some butt whipping. Let me know. We have skills.
Okay, Ernest, and I want to thank you for sharing your audience with me. You're giving me an opportunity to speak to thousands of people rather than just the 25 or 30 I speak to in a Rotary Club, and I wouldn't have that opportunity if you didn't open your doors.
So. And, Peter, go ahead and give out some websites where you'd like people to go or how they can contact you.
Both of these take you to the same place. It's either leap.cc, and people always ask me why CC, and my answer is because .org, .net, .everything else was taken for Leap, so that's the only one we got. And then we picked up a new one, which is copssaylegalizeddrugs.com, and that takes you to the same website. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means any donation to us is tax-deductible and also tells you the government knows about us. And if you're worried about that, I don't think anybody listening to this show would be worried about that.
No, it tells the government that they know about you, too, for donating the Leap.
Yeah, well, that, too. But it does none of our speakers are paid. But we do pay their expenses when they travel and stuff like that, and that costs money. And it also costs money to do the bookings. We have a staff that it takes care of that stuff and keeps us busy. And there's that two old lines. One came from a guy named Niemoller. And it was back in Germany in the 1930s, and he was a reverend. And he's the one that said, when they came to take the gays away, I didn't say anything because I wasn't gay. And when they came to take the Jews away, I didn't say anything because I wasn't a Jew. And when they came to take me away, there wasn't anybody left to say anything. That's the one thing I want to say as a quote. And the other one is, I don't know where it comes from, but it's a great line, and that is, bad things happen because good people stay silent. And don't stay silent. Speak out on this issue. I have a five-minute rule in my life. If I talk to another human being for 5 minutes, we talk about drug policy. And I'm not saying everybody should adopt that, but that's my rule. So you got to talk about this. Bring it up anywhere. Even just give... write down the website and tell them to take a look at Leap's website. I think you'll find a lot of good information there. And, Ernest, I want to thank you again for your time and patience, and it's a pleasure talking to you.
It was my pleasure. Peter Crist, co-founder and current board member of Leap, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, leap.cc. Or you can go to copssaylegalizeddrugs.com. I bet they just love that one. It's been a pleasure, Peter, and you out there listening. This is where it's going. I just want you to understand, the logic is on our side, but we're not dealing with the reasonable. And I don't know where this is going to end, but when it does, it won't be pleasant, and we need to be ready. Because in the end, freedom always wins. It just gets really messy first. Well, that's it for Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Peter Crist, co-founder and current board member of Leap. We'll be right back with another great show